body parts in Evil Dead, including a leg that became possessed. But look at her now, she's a fancy romance novelist. Congratulations to Cheryl, Margaret. Hollywood Book and Poster is a great movie memorabilia place, located in the heart of Hollywood proper. About an hour into my signing there, a tall, trashy-looking woman approached the table. She was wearing the largest sunglasses I'd ever seen, and her sandy brown hair fell in tangles to her waist.
"Oh, hello, Mr. Campbell," she squawked in a very unpleasant voice. "I'm a huge fan of yours, and I just love all your work. I absolutely love the book, too."
This freakish woman was gushing so badly I thought she was going to hemorrhage. What the hell is wrong with this broad, I wondered. I've seen some Hollywood weirdos, but this chick takes the cake. That's when my jaw dropped. Lucy Lawless, that stealthy warrior princess, fooled me hook, line, and sinker. Her post-Xena hair had returned to its normal lighter color, and, to be honest, she was the last person I would have expected to meet in Los Angeles, let alone the Northern Hemisphere. Aside from those lame excuses, lest we forget, Lucy Lawless is also a good actress. What's in a name? Signing as many photographs and mementos as I have over a period of 20 years, I've noticed a slow change in given names. The predictable John, Pete, Sarah, and Sally have become Shauna, Trace E, two E's, Brad Lee, two E's, and Amir. I did my best to combat the back and forth of how do you spell that at signings by encouraging folks to write their own name on a post-it note and slap it on the book. A sandy-haired college kid bounced to the table in Indianapolis and thrust out his hand. "Name's Sean, how you doing?" "Is that S-H-A-W-N or S-H-A-U-N? Sean gave me that you're a dumbass look. "Neither. It's the original spelling, S-E-A-N. "Okay, I'll make a note of that." In Louisville, a very meek woman approached the table. "Hi there," I offered, trying to break the ice. "What's your name?"
"Glad Ray."
Funky names always catch my attention, and I looked up from the book. "Is that two words, Glad and Ray?" She shook her head no. "Just one." I scribbled in her book and handed it back. "Your parents were hippies, weren't they?" Glad Ray blushed a bit, then gathered up her tie-dyed skirt and made off. In this modern age, when individuals tend to migrate more than their forefathers, I just assumed that descendants of famous people are scattered all across the world. I was suitably shocked then when over a two-day span between southern Ohio and Kentucky, I had the pleasure of meeting direct descendants of both Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett at signings. While Daniel's descendant enjoyed using the same formal family name, Davy Crockett's great-great-great-grandnephew was a little more casual about the whole thing. "Ah, just make it out to Dave," he said with a smile. In Philadelphia, at a signing with a tough but friendly crowd, a teenage kid shuffled up to the table, shot a quick look of disdain, and tossed my book on the table. "Sign it." Sensing some hostility, I immediately engaged in small talk. "Sure, buddy, what's your name?"
"Name's Ash."
I smiled. I'd heard that tired gag dozens of times, but the kid's delivery was good. "That's pretty funny," I said. "Seriously, what's your name?" The kid looked at me like I was the biggest asshole he'd ever met. "Seriously, it's Ash," he shot back. "My parents named me after your stupid character." Ash was pissed that plenty of perfectly good names were overlooked in favor of a lame-ass girly name, but he calmed down considerably after getting it off his chest. Perhaps saying it to my face was a cathartic experience. Maybe now Ash could, just like the character, purge himself of the Evil Dead curse. "Well, spelling your name won't be a problem," I said, hoping he'd see the humor in it. Ash was not amused. Parents can be so cruel sometimes. Email. I bought If Chins Could Kill yesterday, hot off the truck. I was in the stockroom of our bookstore when they were unboxing the shipment. I took one, a co-worker took one, two other co-workers were clutching them to their chests like it was the Holy Grail, and the girl with purple hair who works in the cafe took the fifth. Since I am the inventory manager, I immediately went to my desk and shot off an order to our buyer with the message, "All five are being purchased by employees. Can we have some more for the customers?" Donna. Odd job. To quote my buddy Rob Tappert,
"It takes all kinds to fill the freeways."
After getting a presidential candidate's view of the country, all I have to say to that is, brother, ain't that the truth? Sometimes I feel uncomfortable telling people what I do for a living. It usually prompts such a long-winded question and answer session that I tend to offer vague explanations like, I'm self-employed, or I'm an entrepreneur. The Chins Tour connected me with people from all walks of life, and now I don't feel as odd about being an actor. I could always foam-inject tampon applicators like Maurice in Albany, manufacture hemorrhoid surgery equipment like Stan in Dayton, or monitor space junk like George in Boston. So, George, how does that work? I asked, truly interested. George smiled and explained as simply as he could. Well, deep within a computer vault, I track space trash, asteroids, satellites, rocket bodies, basically anything that hangs around the Earth or could hit it. If something dangerous is headed towards, say, a satellite, I notify them. Dangerous, like what? Like a fleck of paint. One of the shuttles got hit by a tiny fleck, scared the hell out of him. Doesn't seem like much, but it's going 6 times faster than a speeding bullet. Gads, sounds like a mess up there. Oh, it is. The launches in the 60s were awfully dirty in that respect, and we're paying the price for it now. Well, thanks for keeping our satellite safe, I wished George as he left. I'd hate to miss an NBA game because of a lousy flake of Dutch boy. I played Monopoly like a fiend when I was a kid. I spent entire summer days battling through 4 and 5 consecutive games while Elton John's Yellow Brick Road kept us company. To this day, I never get tired of playing that game. It's like putting on a worn-in pair of TV slippers. In Providence, Rhode Island, I had the honor of shaking the hand of a young man who made Monopoly pieces. It was nice to put a face to the man who made my favorite piece, the shoe. Oh, and just so you know, the orange and the light blue properties will never steer you wrong, and it wouldn't kill you to own a few railroads. Philadelphia is one of my favorite old cities, simply because it oozes history. I did a book signing at the Grand Course in the Bourse, say that 10 times, a converted factory, otherwise known as Independence Mall. There I had the pleasure to meet the self-proclaimed smut queen of Philadelphia. Barbara places adult service ads in the paper. Well, that must be an interesting life, I replied. Oh, yeah, she said, nodding. You meet all kinds. I leaned toward Barbara and lowered my voice. So tell me, what percentage of your clients actually matched their descriptions? Barbara smiled knowingly and summed it up this way. Well, honey, we are ultimately talking about a fantasy situation here. You might know something about that. I just might, I said, smiling back. Still, I love them to death, Barbara said. Some of my best friends are transvestites. Pittsburgh has a crumbling infrastructure, a fading steel industry, and rampant unemployment. But I love it because it reminds me of Detroit. While at a signing in the Chartier Valley Shopping Center, I connected in a secondhand way with an American icon. As a master of ceremonies, I'd introduce him this way. He's the clown without a frown because he hates to see you down, the one, the only, Ronald McDonald! Granted, I didn't meet Ronald himself, but his assistant stopped by to grab a book and say hello. Wow, your boss must be like Ronald the 15th, I guess. How many of those guys have there been? There's only one, he stated flatly. At a time, right? There's only one, he repeated again, as if he'd heard this stupid reasoning 1,000 times from 9-year-olds. I decided to change tact. So, what's it like to be Ronnie's assistant? Well, as you might expect, he's a very busy guy. Oh, I would assume so, especially since, and we naturally fell into sync together for, there's only one. Tampa produced a threesome of 20-something suburban kids at the table, who immediately burst into laughter when I asked them what keeps them busy. After exchanging nervous looks, one of them stepped forward to explain, "We're Disney characters in Orlando." Now, I burst into laughter, but I wasn't mocking them. I was actually impressed. Riding in the humid Orlando heat while bratty kids pull your ears and stomp on your paws doesn't sound easy, or even fun for that matter. Secretly, I've always wondered what else happens on the job at places like Disney World. Okay, so tell me you don't have grainy black and white pictures of Goofy humping Snow White's leg. I wasn't sure whether this would offend or not. It just sort of came out, but they burst into laughter again. We do, offered Goofy, without an ounce of humor in his voice, and the videos. He then proceeded to share tales of lewd acts performed deep below the happiest place on earth. The signing in Arlington, Virginia, birthplace of the phrase strictly need to know, started off like any other. Folks in this part of the world tend to work for the government, often in the military, so they were very well-groomed, very buttoned down. At my table, one such tidy man stepped up. "Howdy, what's your name, buddy?" I asked. "Robert," he said simply. I began to sign his book. Usually this is a good time to continue the small talk. "So, Robert, what do you do?" "I can't tell you." Our proximity to Washington, D.C. prompted a good chuckle from me. "Yeah, that's a good one. Seriously, what do you do?" Robert looked at me as only a member of a covert elite operation could. "I can't tell you," he repeated emotionlessly. Still convinced he was joking, I added, "Or what, he'll have to kill me?" This time Robert didn't respond. He just stared at me with a CIA-gone-bad look in his cold, dead eyes. "Okay," I said, quickly scribbling "Stay Groovy" and handed the book back. "You have a good one, Robert, whatever it is you do." The Handshake. Handshake definition, noun, the grasping of hands by two people, as in greetings or leave-taking. To shake or not to shake, that is the question. The act of interfacing with fans, I prefer the term clients, in person, always provides hours of awkward quirkiness. I've been in front of crowds of varying sizes for 30 years, if you count community theater, so schmoozing is a natural part of what I do. For some guy who doesn't get out much, meeting an actor that they've followed and supported for years can be a big deal. This leads us to a discussion about the handshake. I've found after shaking enough hands to land a seat in Congress, a person's handshake is as unique as their fingerprints. No two people do it the same way. A short and simple handshake was very popular during the book tour, particularly in Middle America. I enjoy how straightforward it is, but if a handshake is too short, it can be misinterpreted as, "Sick, this guy has cooties," or perfunctory, as in, "Okay, I'll shake this guy's hand because everyone else is." Conversely, a long handshake tends to get a little too intimate for me. I've had 30-second handshakes, during which an enthusiastic sort would tell an entire story while squeezing the blood out of my fingers. No handshake discussion would be complete without mentioning the grip. To me, a person's grip is a key indicator. It lets you know who you're dealing with. A firm grip says, "Hi, pal, nice to make your acquaintance." However, if you grip too firmly, it can be intrusive, suggesting, "Yeah, you want a handshake, huh? Okay, let's do it." A weak grip, for my money, signifies disinterest. Every time I encountered a weak handshake, and I'm talking about the real dead fish ones, the person's interest level was pretty much the same. Much like driving, you are how you shake. Let's move on to temperature. Obviously, our bodies all function at slightly different degrees. My wife, Ida, for example, becomes a nuclear reactor when she sleeps. Even on winter evenings, when I should appreciate it, I still have to move to the edge of our bed to keep from sweating. The same applies to hands, and we can't always control our temperature at any given moment. Fans tend to run a little on the nervous side of temperature, therefore, I'm more likely to encounter a colder variety of hand. Every so often, after a long spell of cold customers, I'll grip a nice warm hand and linger there just to soak up the heat. I've noticed that hands also come at you from different angles. Some guys use the biplane approach, banking their hand up and around, eventually crash-landing into your hand. Other folks thrust their hand out well in advance and march it forward as if jousting. I'm still confused and embarrassed on occasions when my African-American brothers do the shake. I am forever failing to remember the pattern of shake, slide, re-grip, over, under, knuckles together, slap, slide back, lock fingers, swipe away. Some patrons will not only shake your hand, they'll clamp the other one on top, thereby preventing any hope of escape. I call this the cling, the clamp, or the boot. As a kid, I got this a lot, particularly from older relatives. I find this to be a more intense yet generally sincere handshake. The old hand on top, grip the little nipper is a staple of church socials. And how about those sweaty handshakes? After hours of research, I found that sweat is more often associated with a cold hand than a warm one. What causes this phenomenon, I'll never understand, but a cold and clammy hand should come with a warning label. Unless you're fully prepared, grasping the equivalent of a cold sausage can stop your heart. One particular fan, Robert, comes to events any time I'm near enough to Canada, his land of origin. He's something of a sensitive fellow, always concerned about my well-being. He'd been to many events previously, but this one particular warm and humid signing grossed him out so much that he offered me a pack of disinfectant wipes afterward. It took me by surprise because up to that point, I never thought about contracting anything from all the interaction. I figured the act of saying a friendly hello in the form of a handshake far outweighs the potential risk of cooties. Every time a signing went long, and we ran up to 5 hours at some events, the pain questions would start. Hey, Bruce, your hand hurt? No, I would explain, now that the steel pins are in. Hey, got carpal tunnel yet? No, it's gone numb, but don't worry, my autograph is so bad, you won't even know the difference. Fortunately, during the course of a long night, my manual duties were divvied up. My left hand, the signing one, is spared the onslaught of my right, which has to fend off chipper grippers all evening. Personally, when it all shakes down, I always prefer a short duration, medium yet full-bodied grip with a dry finish. Sounds more like a fine wine than a handshake. The most deadly combination of them all, and I think you would agree, is the bone crusher. A hard-pumping, below-the-knuckle, enthusiastically long, I-love-all-your-movies kind of shake, with a dose of cold and clammy thrown in just for good measure. If I spot a potentially dangerous candidate approaching, and I can usually tell by their eyes, I have time to direct my hand into the crux of his or hers, thereby avoiding the death grip. Unfortunately, far too many times, I'd turn back from waving at a departing customer and be caught unaware. When all is said and done, the key to a successful and pain-free book tour, hands down, is mental alertness. Gifts that keep on giving. At public appearances, I always walk away with more stuff than I started with. And I'm not talking about money, I'm talking about stuff. A small percentage of fans, clients, call them what you want, I call them smart people, tend to leave things with me. The reasons for this are myriad. It might be a VHS or DVD some perspiring filmmaker can't wait to share, a sketch some artist type did of the crowd while waiting in line, or a budding band member with a CD of their latest tracks. My favorite of these homegrown classics was entitled Bruce Campbell Can Kick Your Ass by Def Vocation from their hot new CD Hunting at the Zoo. I can finally say that I own a pair of underwear that makes my wife whimper. In Royal Oak, Michigan, an eager young man dropped a pair of briefs in front of me. Handcrafted across the crotch was a quote from Army of Darkness. This is my boomstick. Please take them off, Ida whimpered when she saw them for the first time. I never want to see that hideous underwear again. In Dallas, two sexy female police officers presented me with an official police sweatshirt. Now that's a gift I can use. Just think of the possibilities. Now I can randomly pull over any motorist that annoys me, even if it means a high-speed chase, and quell civil disobedience at book signings. Thanks, officers. On occasion, folks don't want to give me anything. They just want to share information or show me something like their new tattoo. It's safe to say that the average Evil Dead fan sports a much higher tattoo per capita ratio than the norm. I'm not complaining, mind you. Tattoos are walking billboards. I've seen inscriptions from all three Evil Dead movies on arms, chests, necks, backs, and legs, even on a few locations that I had to take their word for it. As you might expect, some were very primitive, while others were simply mind-blowing in color, detail, and scope. As a general observation, body piercing is also making a strong showing among fans of all things dead. I'm not easily shocked, but when a guy plunked his arm down on the signing table to show me a row of steel spikes protruding from under the skin, I gasped out loud. Oh, it's okay, he said. It doesn't hurt anymore. Trying to sound more nonchalant than I felt, I asked, how'd you get those spikes to line up like that? I almost didn't want to hear the answer, but he was happy to explain. Ah, no big deal. See, they surgically implanted a steel bar which has threading for the spikes so you can just screw them on and off. And he did, just to illustrate the point. Sure, I thought, you'll want that for easy cleanup. In all my years on the road, he was the only man-bot I ever met. In Tampa, a local fan approached the book table and shared a unique way to watch one of my films. Dude, do you know what my favorite thing to do is? He asked in a tone that was unsettling. Why, no, I responded. Do tell. My favorite thing in the whole world is to drop acid and watch Evil Dead 2. I had heard just about everything from fans, or so I thought, but this was a good one. Yeah, but the movie seems kind of like an acid trip already, I reasoned. Wouldn't that make it seem normal? No, dude, he emphasized. It bruises your brain. I must take a moment to remark that most people at these signings, while odd on occasion, were incredibly patient. Patrons traveled from great distances only to stand in a long line for a handshake, sometimes sweaty, photograph, and a signed book. Some even had to get back to East Nowhere that same night in order to work a 12-hour shift first thing the next morning. To all of you, I say thank you, and I pity you. A gentleman at a signing in Pasadena, who seemed somewhat unsteady in nature, confessed that he had driven for 2.5 hours to get there. "Wow, that's a long way to go," I said sincerely. "Well, it's not that," he explained through a sheepish grin. "I only live 5 miles away, but I have a neurological disorder and I'm not supposed to drive at all, but I wanted to drop by and say hello." Just before a swing through the western states, sub-tour number 26, I got an email from a guy named Nick, who wanted help proposing to his fiancée Michelle at an upcoming signing in Salt Lake City. The plan was for Nick to give the hi sign when they got near the table. I would then write the following note in their book: "Gee, Michelle, Nick would make a great husband, don't you think?" Presumably, Michelle would then look at her fiancé and wonder, only to see him on his knees with ring in hand, and the proposal would follow. I remember emailing Nick back something to the effect of, "Well, I'm happy to help, pal, as long as you're sure she'll say yes." Amazingly, it happened exactly like that. Through eyes welling with tears, Nick offered the ring to his astonished fiancée. "Michelle, will you marry me?" Nick's family, who had formed nearby, immediately burst into tears. "I will, Nick," Michelle said with a conviction that caused her surrounding family to cry. I couldn't help but bless the event, so I stood up and shared the news with the rest of the crowd, and we cheered the hopeful couple. "Godspeed, Nick and Michelle. May you stay married forever." And a quick follow-up, I met them several years later. They are still blissfully married. Because I was in the business of selling books, there was an effort to discourage the signing of memorabilia. But it was, and still is, a tough road to walk. It was important to support the bookstore, yet it was also important to acknowledge folks who came to the store because of the memorabilia. As a result, I signed my share of not only Evil Dead memorabilia, both obscure and official, but plenty of homemade props, drawings, photos from conventions past, Briscoe, Hercules, and Xena pictures, games, DVDs, special editions, and figurines. In Buffalo, I signed something truly unique. A lanky fellow walked up to the table at a leisurely pace. As I reached out my hand in greeting, he plunked the lower half of his right leg on the table, his green prosthetic leg, that is. As I signed it, I couldn't help but tell the only leg joke I know. "Hey, do you know why actors always say break a leg?" "No, why?" "Well, because then they'll be in the cast." The gentleman gave me a weak smile, reattached his signed leg, and walked away. You can't get there from here. Email. While I have not a clue about your feelings regarding the current military campaign in Afghanistan, I think it worth mentioning that your Dead series of films continue to provide a great deal of entertainment to many of my peers in naval aviation. DVDs and tapes of your movies are in the film libraries of many Naval and Marine Corps ships and squadrons. I have even heard, on at least two occasions, people refer to doing a full ash on a particular point, and indeed, an occasional groovy is heard over the radio. ASN Captain USNR. It's a vast understatement to say that domestic travel changed on September 11, 2001. My book tour fell into two distinct halves, pre-9/11 and post-9/11. September 10th, I drove from Southern Oregon to Portland for a signing. After weeks of almost nonstop air travel, it was a treat to travel by car once again. When my wife's cell phone rang the morning of the 11th, she hesitated to answer it. She has nothing against cell phones, but we happened to be making love at the time. Every so often, my wife and I make exceptions during sex to answer phones, doors, or email, and did this time because the call was abnormally early. Ida's sister Mary was on the line. As I listened to Ida's side of the conversation, a terrible story unfolded. "Hi, Mary, how are you?" "Yeah, we're fine." We're up here in Portland for a signing." "No, we drove." "Well, why wouldn't we be okay?" Ida shot me a look like her sister was crazy. "Well, what do you mean with everything going on?" Then Ida's face darkened. "What? Oh, my God." With that, Ida leapt to her feet and turned on the TV. You know the rest. The next day, unlike so many unfortunate travelers stranded in distant cities, we simply drove home. From there, I attempted to keep the book tour on track. More angry than afraid, I wasn't going to alter my routine because of this invasion. I wanted to press on, full speed ahead. The events happened on a Tuesday, and I was due in Florida as part of a southern swing that Friday. My local airport, not nearly able to comply with the new security measures, shut down for an indeterminable period. San Francisco was the next logical choice. Much as I hated the thought and that bloody airport, I knew the only way to catch a flight was to drive there. Flight information for Thursday was iffy. It wasn't clear what flights were operating and to where. So I decided to roll the dice, rent a one-way car, and head down to the city of flight delays. By the time I got to San Francisco that night, the flight was canceled. Fortunately, the next morning, it looked like a flight was going out, so I gave it a shot. I rolled my bag up to the curbside at 6 a.m. that Friday morning, but it didn't look anything like the San Francisco International Airport. Bangladesh was more like it. Curbside check-in, the great staple of business travel, had been discontinued, so everything had to be processed at one place, the ticket counters. "Good God," I muttered as I stepped inside the terminal, trying to orient myself. Three or four seemingly endless lines intersected each other in ways that didn't make any sense. The first challenge of deciphering the newly heightened security system was determining which massively long line to stand in. Asking an airline employee how things worked didn't help much, and I'm not just being snide. A lot of them really didn't know because information was being updated all the time. By chance, I had been able to redeem enough air miles for a business class upgrade, and I was extremely glad I did. My wait, although long and tedious, was nothing like coach, where the line curved away until you couldn't see the end. Once I passed through security, the airport was quiet as a tomb. The incessant announcements about flight status that usually boomed from every direction were now short and sporadic. The airport may have been open, but nothing else was. All of the pre-boarding rituals that I took for granted were suddenly gone. The breakfast at Wolfgang Puck's, the chai steamer at Starbucks, the USA Today, the bottle of water for the flight. As I rifled through my bag in search of a stashed power bar, I came across a nail file, one of the many new carry-on taboos. We were all flying so soon after September 11th that even the heightened security was still working itself out. The flight itself was somber, with passengers exchanging slow, lingering looks. Food service arrived just in the nick of time. Between flight cancellations and several delays, I was starving. As I unrolled my cloth napkin, the silverware tumbled out. A metal fork, a metal spoon, and a plastic knife. A sheer sign of the new times we lived in. The flight was otherwise uneventful, and we applauded when the plane landed. I can't remember the last time that happened. At the gate, we were greeted by a handful of applauding American Airlines employees who were hoisting an enormous American flag and passing out roses to each of us as we passed. Considering everything that had been happening, it was a very welcome, lighter moment. The Misadventures of Carla. A book tour is like a road trip without the fun. I came within a half an hour of the most beautiful landmarks this country has to offer, but I never had time to visit them. A number of the book tour legs were accomplished by flying to a given city, traveling by car through the surrounding region, then returning home. Each stop along the tour brought with it a new list of addresses to locate: the bookstore itself, my hotel, radio and TV stations, book warehouses, etc. To make sure we stayed on schedule, and it was very tight most of the time, I enlisted the help of Hertz's Never Lost system. After a few misguided attempts to navigate from point A to B, I renamed it Ever Lost. The robotic female voice that announces directions was testy at best, confused often, and incommunicative when I really needed her. In honor of an old girlfriend with the same characteristics, and because it seemed fitting, I dubbed her Carla. Once I programmed a route, if I made any changes, like searching for lunch or a bathroom stop, Carla would reprimand me like a nun.
"Please return to the highlighted route," she would admonish.
"Please guide me to a hardware store so I can buy a hammer and smash you to pieces," I would reply. Part of the problem arose from the fact that Carla relied on satellite connections to triangulate her location. Under certain conditions, she couldn't find all four positioning satellites, and when that happened, all bets were off. "Exit on the right in approximately 1 mile, Carla droned. "Oh, really, would that be the exit I passed 2 miles ago, Carla?" At numerous points along the route, Ida and I would find ourselves in rural areas. Carla's little CD-sized brain could only hold so much information, and the small car icon, which symbolized our approximate location, spent plenty of time floating in a dark void on the screen. When I'm on a deadline, I prefer short, straight routes with little chance of getting lost or delayed. Ida, on the other hand, loves what I call long cuts. She'll go out of her way to avoid repetition, often steering us far from the main drag. Driving from Oregon to Los Angeles, Ida became irritated by the hot, hazy 5 freeway in Central California and decided to find an alternate route. Rifling through a stack of maps, she eventually found what she was looking for, a pass over the Sierra Mountains that would take us to US 395, a far more primitive yet beautiful southern route to Los Angeles. To get there, we had to cross the Sierra Mountains. When the Intercontinental Railroad was constructed there in the 1860s, it was a feat considered nearly impossible. Ida's long cut across Highway 120 seemed just as bad as we churned up a winding grade over the Tioga Pass, just shy of 10,000 feet in elevation. Within 2 hours of taking the new route, the outside temperature had plummeted from 99 degrees in the San Joaquin Valley to 52. The heat problem was solved, and the scenery was outrageous as we crossed the north side of Yosemite Valley. Near the end of the bypass, the sun made a fast exit, and we found ourselves running short of 3 critical things: daylight, gasoline, and brake pads. Stopping our car was the biggest problem of the 3, as Ida and I soon discovered on her descent. Snaking down a steep grade with a massive gorge on our right, minus guardrails, is the wrong time for brakes to go out, but that's just when they did. "Bruce, I can't slow down," Ida said with an urgency you don't hear often except in movies. "I think the brakes are shot." Several years ago on Christmas Day, I lost control of our Subaru while driving down an icy slope and flipped our car upside down in a ravine, so I was immediately familiar with the feeling of impending doom as it welled up inside. Getting to a safe area on our left meant cutting across oncoming traffic, but without brakes, we had no control over when to do it. I suggested that Ida downshift and duck over at the first opportunity. With a sharp tug on the wheel at the right moment, Ida managed to pull off and eventually stop with the help of the emergency brake. After a rest to cool down the brakes and change our undergarments, we were back on the road again. In the funk that followed 9/11, I found myself driving across much of Florida, including Miami, Fort Lauderdale, locally referred to as Fort Lickerdale, Tampa, and Atlantic Beach. I'd never seen more flags on display in my life. Every other car had something red, white, and blue hanging from an antenna or stuck to a window. In downtown Fort Lauderdale, tandem pickup trucks cruised side by side down the main drag with giant flags propped up Iwo Jima style in their rear beds, with cheering, liquor-toting students shouting pro-USA slogans. Given the nature of this spring break haven, I'm not sure they were all that patriotic. Just seemed like another excuse to party. Tampa had a weird Omega Man feel by the time I got there on September 17th. Only 6 days after the attacks, most traveling businessmen were still trying to get back home, let alone make sales calls. As a result, I had the run of the Wyndham Harbor Island Resort that night. The restaurant was wide open, and the hotel lounge, usually 2 layers deep with Joe the lawyer and Mo the industrial sales rep, was empty. As I traversed Alligator Alley, the only highway to cross the Everglades, pro-American songs filled the airwaves, some not played since the late 50s. You know something big had happened to our country when they dust off John Wayne's spoken rendition of America the Beautiful. The station was WJGO, Groovy 102.9. I remembered it because they used my character Ash's Groovy line as a station ID. I got a good chuckle out of it, then called my lawyer. Whether you like it or not. Email. The highest accolade a funny guy can aspire to is making your audience's milk come out their nose. It was true in fourth grade, and it's still true today, now that we're in our 40s. Your accounts of Weezer's mishaps and Goodman's chili caused some serious nasal complications for me, so you owe me a new blotter, wise ass. Ellen, College of William and Mary. At various points during the book tour, Ida and I began to feel like we worked for the Postal Service. Books had to get signed come rain or shine, hell or high water. Weather-wise, on this book tour, we encountered a little bit of everything. During the course of several months traveling across a very large country, you were bound to wind up in the right state at the right time and, conversely, the wrong state at the wrong time, like Las Vegas, Nevada in August, or Savannah, Georgia, any time of the year. Boston decided to take a breather from its protracted drought when I passed through in the fall and dumped about an inch and a half of rain in 2 hours. Cleveland said hello to my landing aircraft with a combination of snow and lightning. As the turbulence rocked our cabin like a bad disaster movie, all I could think to myself was, only in the Midwest. Flagstaff, Arizona can't be trusted at any time of the year. I'd passed through there once before on a cross-country drive and had to stop to buy emergency snow gear because of a freak blizzard. When we stopped in Flagstaff during the tour, Ida and I got caught in a wicked hailstorm, in August, mind you, and the wind was so furious that it blew horizontally. Occasionally, after inflicting untold cruelty, the weather gods would smile, and I found myself in places like New England in the fall. Clichés abound about how vibrant the colors are and how quaint the towns are, and guess what? It's all true. For those of you who have never done it before, get going. Overall, I found a great irony in traveling by car during the heart of the summer. It's also the best time for every state in the Union to haul out the heavy equipment and dissect every road ever built. Passing through Buffalo in the late fall, where winter had already been threatening, a local explained the situation this way. Buffalo only has two seasons, winter and construction. Diversions along the way. Every so often during the five-month tour, I'd get a free evening between cities or a couple hours some morning, and each time I was confronted with the same question, what should I do? I found that 50% of the time, the chances of finding something fun to do were just as good if I skipped the phone call to the concierge, skipped the yellow pages, skipped the internet search, and just got out of the hotel. If I wanted to break the monotony of the road, I had to get off my lazy ass and make it happen. In every case, even if my search turned up nothing, it was always more fruitful than watching the CNN headline news cycle through their report 5 consecutive times. It's amazing how many adventures lie within a 5-mile radius of wherever you are. My hotel in Baltimore connected to a light rail system that ran all the way to Camden Yards, the legendary ballpark. With a growling stomach, that sounded good enough for me. I was sure to find a place to eat somewhere along the way. As the train pulled up near the stadium, I saw the backside of a bank of lights, and they were on. Exiting the car, I heard a huge roar from the crowd within, and my suspicions were confirmed. Holy shit, I thought, there's a ball game on tonight. I hustled over to the ticket window. How much have I missed? I asked the attendant. Not much, he said. It's the bottom of the third. Works for me, I said, digging out a credit card. I'll take one of your finest seats. With Bud and Bratwurst in hand, I made my way to what was an excellent seat. It was perfect baseball weather. A clear, warm night with a slight breeze from right field. To my utter joy, future Hall of Famer Cal Ripken was at bat. 2001 was to be his last season, and home games usually sold more tickets because fans just wanted to see him play one last time. Now retired, Cal was a pillar of strength for the Baltimore Orioles for just about 20 years, an eternity in professional sports. No sooner had I focused my attention on the action when, whack, Cal ripped one right up the center for a base hit. Not bad for a book tour, I thought. I love to walk. When you're hustling from city to city, you can't always get that Body by Jake workout in, but you can almost always find a place to walk. Traveling by foot is the best way to get the feel of a city or neighborhood. Does it smell? Is it loud? Are there even sidewalks? In Washington, D.C., I took advantage of an early night to stroll along Embassy Row. It was fascinating to see the different styles from the large British embassy to the sleek Danish embassy and even the ratty one representing Belize. Sorry, Belize. But as I walked further away from the center of town, the embassies thinned out, and I found myself next to an imposing black metal fence. Layered banks of bright lights shined from within the grounds toward the street, thereby blinding any would-be intruders, or passers-by for that matter. Behind the fence, patrolling soldiers in Navy uniforms scanned the compound with flashlights. By the look of things, it was either the home of some rich jerk with a bad case of paranoia, or an embassy that didn't want any visitors. As I neared the gated entrance, a sign cleared everything up. Naval Observatory, home of the atomic clock. Well, that's a bit of a letdown, I thought, and turned around. On the way back, I passed a patrolling soldier, this time outside the fence. I smiled and nodded with a good evening. He must have been programmed not to respond, because he walked by without looking up or saying a word. Big deal, I reasoned. What is so precious about an atomic clock that it has to be protected 24 hours a day? The next day, appearing on a morning show, I was embarrassed to learn that the Naval Observatory houses more than the atomic clock. Vice President Dick Cheney stays there, too. Or did. During the course of the tour, I walked along highways, rural roads, railroad tracks, through Central Park in New York City, across government land, through every strata of neighborhood, and, when all else failed, around airport terminals. I got the shock of my life in Atlanta one evening. A huge park, positively riddled with walking paths, was directly accessible from my hotel, and seemingly, I had the joint to myself. But as I walked, I couldn't help feeling that I was being watched. I'm a sturdy guy, and I can take care of myself in most scenarios, but I wasn't getting the I'm gonna rob you vibe from the shadows. I was getting the come into the shadows for a good time vibe. Then it made sense. As I walked near weeping willow trees that surrounded a beautiful pond, numerous men stood up from park benches or stepped into the light so I could see them. As I picked up my pace ever so slightly, the only thing I could see clearly that night was the desperation on their faces. The Appalachian National Scenic Trail has an entirely different vibe. It says, I'll bet you can't hike me for 2,167 miles from Maine to Georgia. This old trail, the first of its kind in 1937, had always fascinated me. The idea that a single footpath runs the entire distance is positively medieval. I've walked a few miles on sections of it in Georgia while visiting relatives, once while working on a film in Rutland, Vermont, and the last time in Dalton, Massachusetts, smack dab in the middle of the book tour. To those who seek outdoor activities, the Appalachian Trail is a legend. To the locals around Dalton, it doesn't exist. Honestly, they had no idea what I was talking about. Finally, at a laundromat, which made sense considering the amount of backpackers doing laundry there, they pointed me to an area where I could access a trailhead. That October 13th, fall was in full swing in New England. Colors were at their absolute peak, the sky was clear, and a crisp breeze juggled 1,000 falling leaves at a time. As I drove several miles to the trailhead, Skippy the Squirrel absolutely pelted my car with acorns the size of walnuts. At the trail entrance, I was faced with the option of hiking north or south. I chose north, but it didn't really make any difference. Either way, I was on the trail. An interesting thing about the AT, that's the insider term, is that although winding through woods most of the time, it's never far from numerous small, medium, and large towns. This allowed me to take a walk with Ida for about a mile via cell phone. Ida and I have gotten used to this routine when we can't travel together. It's a way of sharing experiences and recapping the day, much like you would if you were actually walking together. It's freakish, I know, but it's just another attempt to stay connected amid the chaos. I hiked for several hours, then came across a forest glade on the crest of a hill. It seemed ideal for just about anything, but at that moment, a nap was the first order of business. I wadded my fleece vest into a pillow and passed out for an hour. Walking back to the car, worn out but utterly satisfied, I wondered if I had the stuff to walk all 2,000-some-odd grueling miles of this Appalachian Trail, camping out every night for months in every imaginable weather condition, eating freeze-dried food and washing my clothes once every 3 or 4 days, if that. The trail and I have yet to come to terms, but the concept will remain in my mind until more fully addressed in the future. It seems like everyone has a cell phone these days. At a gathering of any reasonable size, you can pretty much guarantee that some yahoo's phone will ring. Because book signings lasted well into the evening on occasion, I found that prank phone calls provided the perfect break for both the crowd and my signing hand. As a kid, prank phone calls were a staple of my life. Long before caller ID, I learned to ad-lib my way in or out of most anything. In retrospect, it was fine acting training. When a phone rang during my readings, Q&A sessions, or signings, I'd try and grab it before anyone could answer. "Hello, Mom," I said, glancing at Mom on the cell phone screen. "Who is this?" the concerned woman asked after an initial pause. "I'm," silently asking the cell phone owner for his name, "I'm Tim." "No, you're not," she said, getting more forceful yet frightened at the same time. "My God, what have you done with my little Timmy?" When I wasn't raining terror in the hearts of families, I woke up wives, interrupted important meetings, left voicemail greetings, and bitched about a rented gorilla suit, all with the blessing of knowing participants. "Smith & Sons Costumes? Yes, George Abernathy here. I rented a gorilla suit from you, and I gotta tell you, it just stinks to high heaven. Do you fumigate these things?" "Yes, we do, sir." With what? Locker room towels? Sir, I'm very sorry you're having this problem, he said without a bit of remorse, but I can't help you. Why not? I asked. Because we don't even have a gorilla costume in stock. We only carry an orangutan, and it's here in the store. Yeah, but you see, hey, aren't you a little old to be making prank phone calls? He scolded and hung up. I'm not sure about your summer of 2001, but mine was hot. I drove through significant parts of the West and Pacific Northwest during July and August. On a hot road trip, you can almost always find a motel with a pool, but more often than not, they're closed for repair, or should be. And even if kids haven't been whizzing in them all day, most modern-day pools are too small to really swim in. Ida and I accepted the challenge to find more interesting ways to stay cool along the way. To accommodate a chance discovery or quick impulse, we traveled in our bathing suits between bookstores across much of the West. Aside from storing massive amounts of nuclear waste, Nevada generally has clean air, strong wind, and, aside from Las Vegas, plenty of isolation. It doesn't have much in the way of water, but, like much of the West, Nevada has a network of dams and reservoirs that are relatively available to the public. Topaz Lake, a multi-use reservoir, provided one of the most beautiful late-afternoon summer experiences I've had since childhood. Water in the reservoir was bathwater warm, surprisingly clear, and there wasn't but a handful of other people in this gigantic man-made lake in the middle of nowhere. Reservoirs come in all sizes and degree of development. In rural California, I waded through a soggy shoreline marsh to access a nameless reservoir. High in the Sierras, Convict Lake is formed by nothing more than an old mining dam, and its snow-fed waters will eject your frigid body in seconds. Larger reservoirs, many of them the end result of Depression-era work projects, are usually outside large metropolitan areas and aren't as scenic. Driving back to Oregon after a batch of signings in Los Angeles, Ida and I stopped at Castaic Lake, a large reservoir just north of the city. In contrast to Topaz, access to this one was easy, and it was close to a giant city. As a result, it was completely overrun by humans to a massive degree, most of them loitering, littering, or cranking up boomboxes, anything but swimming. We also enjoyed dunking in the odd river, like the Sacramento, and in streams, tributaries, ponds, and even a quick dip in the Pacific Ocean. Gambling seems to be more and more prevalent in our society. In obscure regions of the West, new casinos have sprung up like buckbrush in May. This is due in part because Native Americans have recently begun to use their sovereign right to set up houses of gaming. The long-term success or failure for the Native Americans remains to be seen, but for the short term, they are making money, some of it from me. That's right, every so often, if a casino was on the way, I'd cough up my limit of $100 and let the one-armed bandits have their way with me. Staying at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas was a trip. The entrance alone looked more like curbside check-in at American Airlines than a hotel. Inside, the scale of the casino was hard to take in. These monstrosities are now a combination of mall and resort, where kids can play while their parents sneak off to gamble their vacation money away. I was glad to see that the old adage about gambling is still true. Giant casinos aren't built because they lose money. I proved that again at a casino in Windsor, Ontario, where I lost another $100. This time I reasoned that it was a loss of only $66 once you factored in the exchange rate. Yeah, that's it. I considered myself lucky and haven't been to a casino since. Because If Chins Could Kill celebrates the independent filmmaker, I knew the book tour wouldn't be complete without a swing through the small town that hosted the original Evil Dead, Morristown, Tennessee. By sheer coincidence, I was scheduled to be in Knoxville, Tennessee, a mere 40 miles away on November 2nd. A trip to the cabin site was a great idea, but I hadn't been back there in years or stayed in touch with our local contact, Gary Holt. Fate smiled on me during an interview with a Knoxville journalist who was pretty keen to watch this happen when I mentioned it. He was from the Morristown area originally and had a good idea where to look for Gary. Amazingly, several weeks later, I got a call from this intrepid reporter saying that he had not only contacted Gary, but he arranged for lunch at the Little Dutch Restaurant, an old haunt during the filming, and a trip to the cabin. The idea was to hook up with Gary somewhere off the road outside of Morristown. I was driving in from Nashville that morning and had to hustle to make the 1 o'clock rendezvous. In actuality, it wasn't hard to spot Gary. He was, without a doubt, the only person driving a canary yellow Dodge Viper in Morristown, Tennessee. Gary was in good spirits, had taken good care of himself, and most importantly, kept his entrepreneurial spirit alive and well. His latest endeavor was an auto body painter's color palette. Essentially, it's a simple device that helps him match new coats of paint with original auto body colors. Obscure as that may sound, Gary was starting to sell his invention to mainstream auto supply stores and had his own sweatshop set up in the headquarters of the family business. In all, Gary kept enough plates in the air to maintain a high quality of life in rural Tennessee. Lunch at the Little Dutch, a restaurant symbolic of much more than a couple of meals 22 years ago, was very enjoyable. Gary brought along his new lady friend and we dredged up the old war stories for over an hour. It was interesting to hear Gary's perspective on the Evil Dead experience so many years later. More than anything, I was shocked at how much I had forgotten of the whole experience. The true mission of the day was to visit the original cabin site. Granted, it burned to the ground in 1982, but that wasn't the point. I just wanted to stop by, take a few pictures, and pay my respects. Heading east from Morristown on 11E, we turned right on Kidwell Ridge Road, took another right on... Oh, hey, wait a minute. That's way too much information. Sorry, folks, but I would hate to contribute to the delinquency of a minor by encouraging further plunder of this semi-secret place. I'd been to the cabin location two previous times, once when it was still intact and once when it burned down. But the surrounding woods were outrageously overgrown each time, and I never got the full effect. The latest visit was by far the spookiest because it finally coincided with the time of year when the film was shot. As a result, the access road, the surrounding woods, and the cabin site all looked exactly like they did in 1979. Vegetation had died off, and the swamp grass, as we called it, was bent and dried in exactly the same manner. What differed was the scale of things. The images in my mind were all bigger, but the present-day reality was smaller, less defined. The driveway wasn't as long or steep, the woods weren't as foreboding or thick, and the cabin location wasn't as far from civilization as it was in my memory. Still, it was a thrill to go back for a look around. Memories were plentiful, and most of them were good. The End of the Beginning. All epic journeys must end, and this one sputtered to a halt with a makeup book signing in Miami. The first attempt, scheduled for September 14, 2001, had been canceled for obvious reasons. At other signings, I never gave much thought about what the turnout would be, but the competition that rainy night, November 4, 2001, was fierce. Game 7 of the World Series, the Emmy Awards, and Hurricane Michelle. I'd love to say that we ended the tour with a sellout, slam dunk event in Miami, but we didn't. It was a very quiet night as a result, and everyone went home early. As in movies, so in publishing, sometimes you take one on the chin. And here's a little Miami update. Ironically, years later, I wound up doing a TV show, and I'm still doing it in Miami. I'm on my fourth year down there, so every time I went to Miami before, I bombed. Now we've got the number one show on cable. Go figure. I never went to my 20-year high school reunion because it coincided with the first episode I ever did as a guest star on the TV show Ellen. The travel gods were simply against making both possible, so I opted for employment, the only choice an actor can make, and never gave it a second thought. I'm happy to report, however, that 6 years later, my reunion experience finally came to fruition during the 20-year anniversary of the film that started this whole mess. Anchor Bay Releasing, the Michigan-based distribution company, hosted a screening that coincided with the theatrical re-release of Evil Dead, complete with a much-needed audio-visual facelift. Staged in Royal Oak, Michigan, my birthplace by coincidence, the screening and subsequent party took place in and around the main theater downtown. A mainstay of my childhood, the Spruced Up Theater was a perfect place to relaunch the flick. Ironically, this sleepy Detroit suburb, known in my youth as Royal Joke, has since transformed itself into a hip place complete with franchise stores, cool bars, and trendy, dare I say, pricey restaurants. Miraculously, Anchor Bay located each of the five cast members, and even Tom Sullivan, our makeup guru. Professionally, I had not worked with the Evil Dead actors in two decades, and had spoken with them only sporadically since, but as we all assembled at the Anchor Bay offices to prepare for the evening, none of us could keep from smiling. Regardless of what had happened in between, we all shared the same unforgettable first film experience. Within 15 minutes, I was kicking Ellen Sandweiss under the table and referring to her as Ellen Sandflies, as I did in high school, and we fell back into the familiar patter like old pals for the rest of the evening. The thing that really struck me about the event, as we interacted with a horde of Evil Dead fans, was how dumbfounded the other cast members were by the following this crude horror flick from their distant past had since gained. You could tell by the look on the faces of Betsy, Ellen, Teresa, Rich, and Tom as they stepped out of the white stretch limo for a grand entrance. This was all pretty new. The screening went as expected. I had seen the film so many times that I knew exactly when the audience reactions would come, so it was way more fun to watch the next generation, like my nephew Colin, scream and laugh their asses off. Afterward, the cast and crew assembled to field questions. It came out that Ellen Sandweiss, Betsy Baker, and Teresa Tilly had recently formed their own subgroup called Ladies of the Evil Dead and were taking their act on the road to conventions across the land. Tom Sullivan, for his part, had jumped back into the game as well, doing appearances and makeup demonstrations. Rich DeManicourt, known in the film as Hal Delrich, was the only sensible one of the bunch. Now working as a bidder for a local contractor in Michigan, Rich summed up his feelings when he introduced himself. "Hi, folks, I'm Rich DeManicourt, and none of this hoopla means anything to me, because I have a real job." He said it with a smile, and the audience roared with laughter, but I must say, as someone who is perhaps too close to these films, I appreciated his healthy perspective. One of the amazing things about motion pictures is that they never go away. They just sit on a shelf somewhere until someone can dream up a new way to present them in theaters, on TV, DVD, or some completely new technology. In the Evil Dead case, I chuckle about the irony that my first film performance, when I was the least experienced, would more or less get the most attention. Whatever the case, I'm glad that the hardworking people behind the scenes who put in long hours on the Evil Dead films will be recognized as well by the newfound popularity. I'm equally pleased that fans around the world still seem to enjoy these ridiculous films, even if fanatically so. Parting thoughts. The book tour came to symbolize the end of an era. And I'm not talking about the American way of life. I'm talking about my laundry bag. Before I eulogize this nylon sack, I'll give you some background. During the post-production of the first Evil Dead in New York City, Sam Raimi, Rob Tappert, and I lived in a small apartment on 60th between 1st and York Street. And it was this neighborhood where I bought the purple nylon laundry sack. Once a week for the next several months, I'd drop off my nasties, spend the day making scary sounds in a dark studio, then pick up my fluffed and folded laundry in the evening. For the next 20 years, that simple bag with a fading Campbell scrawled in magic marker accompanied me around the world. It's a stupid attachment, I know. But for me, it forever symbolized the independent filmmaking spirit, the excitement of going to the big city and finding my fortune. I'm speaking about the purple bag in the past tense because, sadly, during the filming of Serving Sarah in Dallas, my dear wife Ida unwittingly delivered a death blow to the old soldier. Carrying a heavy load of clothes to the laundromat, she opted to drag the bag on the sidewalk part of the way. What resulted was a fatal road rash, decimating all support in the most critical part of the bag, the bottom. Deep in denial, I bought a new yellow nylon laundry bag, but still attempted to use the crippled one on short, light laundry business trips. Near the end of the book tour, outside of Albany, New York, Mr. Purple lost the will to carry anything, and I had to put him down. Born in New York, dragged to death in Texas, that little nylon bag lived a full and varied life. Mr. Purple, may you carry only fresh, clean clothes up there in nylon laundry bag heaven. So long, old friend. You've served me well. After hawking If Chins Could Kill, Confessions of a B-Movie Actor from June 8th to November 4th, 2001, crisscrossing the country one too many times for my own good, I now understand why rock and roll band members become disoriented on long tours, lose track of days, and trash their hotel rooms. But in spite of my incessant whining, I'd be a fool to deny that this was a great time to be traveling, to reassure myself that we weren't going to fall apart as a country anytime soon. And, as always, I enjoyed visiting your cities, dear listener, for some in-person, off-the-record shenanigans. And just so you know, because of your support and bulging wallets, Chins jumped on and off the extended New York Times bestseller list 8 times during its release, peaking at number 19. For that and everything else, you have my sincere thanks. Bruce Campbell, February 8th, 2010. Acknowledgements. This is an email of suggested book titles from a fan named Andre. Shame and Perversion, The Bruce Campbell Story. Silicone and Subterfuge, My Low-Budget Life. Why Does It Hurt When I Pee, The Bruce Campbell Story. Broken Dreams and Power Bars, A Life. My Chin Can Hurt People. No Autographs, Please. Doomed to Shake Hands with Creepy Guys at Conventions. I Met Tom Arnold but Didn't Kill Him. Weasels Rip My Flesh, How to Sorta Succeed in Hollywood. Fake Mustache, The Bruce Campbell Curse. From Super 8 to Superstar, 20 Steps to Sci-Fi Channel Originals. Thank you, Andre. 100 years ago, a guy named John Hodgman contacted me by email. Ever thought about writing a book, he wrote? John, it turned out, was a literary agent in New York. Yeah, right, I answered. Another actor writes a lame-ass book. Snoresville, baby. John refused to back off based on a series of rants and anecdotes I had posted on my website. He was convinced that if I could put together a demo book, a publisher would step up to the plate. Here's a quick update to John Hodgman, by the way. He went from being a lowly assistant literary agent to then writing his own book. Then he got on the Daily Show, and he does correspondence for the Daily Show, and he wound up also being the PC in those famous Apple PC commercials. So that son of a bitch makes more residuals than I do now. From here, we went to Cannes, France, about a month later. I was walking through the lobby of the hoity-toity Carlton Hotel, searching for a business associate, when a Dutch fellow collared me. Mr. Campbell, I have an excellent screenplay for you to star in. I was in Cannes for the film festival, so hawking projects like this happens about 5 times every nanosecond. Sure, pal, I responded with a smile and accepted his manuscript. Later, while sipping a $9 7-Up, I thumbed through the incomprehensible manuscript. It would make a terrible film, but the backside of this permanently bound document would be perfect to jot down a jumble of my memories, incidents, and anecdotes. I hope I run into that Dutch guy again, because I'll tell him with all sincerity that I got a lot out of his script. However, I realized that if a book was going to be made out of all this, I had to clear out the cobwebs, get organized, and break open the proverbial cookie jar. In my attic, I rummaged through high school-era diaries, old business logs, and photographs. A more complete picture began to form, but it wasn't until I paid a visit to Buddy Scott Spiegel's apartment that it all came into sharp focus. Scott, for as long as I've known him, has never thrown out a script, a letter, a ticket stub, nothing. Sifting through these artifacts whipped my mental pot into a frenzy, and fresh stories sprung to life. With a combination of excitement and trepidation, I proceeded to write a Cliff Notes version of this book. To jazz up the look of it, I enlisted my trustworthy assistant, Craig Sanborn. He's one of those infuriatingly computer-literate guys who can master a new software program in minutes. This ability, combined with a good sense of art direction, made Craig an integral part of this book. We let technology assist us in this new medium. Multiple software and hardware purchases later, we kicked out a 90-page proposal that was distributed to about a dozen publishers in New York City. As expected, 50% of the prospective buyers fell away immediately. Writing a book about the unglamorous side of Hollywood was about as exciting to some publishers as a mom-and-pop soda shop would be to a Fortune 500 company. Still, a few curious publishers dangled in uncertainty, and a meet-the-press trip to the Big Apple followed. 50% of the 50% fell away upon meeting in person. Ha! Must have been my aftershave. And we were left with but a brave few. St. Martin's Press, in their wisdom/foolishness, decided to give me a shot on this tale of Hollywood's unrecognized lower middle class. Once a contract was signed and the celebrations tapered off, I was left with the realization that I actually had to write the damn thing. A year was provided to piece it all together, and the first 6 months flew by without a blink. Hey, I'm a busy actor, I told myself. I'll get to it. Eventually, a deadline loomed and I had to get my doughy butt in gear. In compiling this book, I relied upon the good graces of many folks, in particular, my old pals from the Michigan days. In order to jolt our collective memories, I interviewed most of them, much like a cub reporter. It was great to rehash the stories and challenges of the past, and I owe a great deal of thanks to Jan Holbrook for wading through the 18 tapes, transcribing hours of non sequiturs, inside jokes, and unexplained laughter. Because my day job as an actor kept me very busy during this time, I wrote this book in my spare time. During film shoots, it meant knuckling down after 7 in the evening or on weekends. Airplanes also provided a fine opportunity to write, As a captive passenger, there was often no better way to pass those 1, 3, 5, or 12-hour flights. In case it's of any interest at all, this book was concocted in 2 hemispheres on 3 continents. Handwritten musings were hammered into a structure from a groovy bachelor pad in Paris and at my former home in Los Angeles, California. The lion's share of the real work was assembled in countless hotels, apartments, and townhouses around Auckland, New Zealand, not to mention my trailer on set. I can't tell you how often I shouted to an assistant director, "Okay, be right there," as I typed the last few thoughts before dashing out to torment Hercules or Xena. Chapters were tweaked in enough cities to choke a Rand McNally guide. As much as I would have enjoyed writing in some idyllic locale, undisturbed for months on end, it simply wasn't in the cards. I also want to thank my editor, Barry Neville, for forcing this book down the throat of Thomas Dunn Books. I wasn't privy to the backroom arm-twisting, but I'm sure it cost Barry dearly. Because this book took 4 years to complete, I wasn't really surprised when Barry called to tell me that he was moving away from publishing. "Bruce, hey, I just hope it wasn't because of this book." "Barry, well, I have suffered the tortures of the damned for you, but I've got some other opportunities I want to explore." Fortunately for me, Barry's superior, Pete Wolverton, took the reins as my new editor boss, and I hardly got lectured at all. I'd be remiss if I left out a nod to Mike Ditz, chronicler of my childhood. Without his ever-present camera lens, much of the pictures in this book would not exist. An official thanks is long overdue. As always, I owe a great debt to my wife and my 2 kids, Rebecca and Andy. They have been extremely patient with me. Their support remains underappreciated, and any attempt to make up for it now would be unsatisfactory. Fortunately, they know how cool they are. The end.
This has been If Chins Could Kill, Confessions of a B-Movie Actor. Written and narrated by Bruce Campbell. Original copyright 2002 by Bruce Campbell. Production copyright 2010 by Bruce Campbell.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.